Hi, everybody. Welcome along to our class tonight, and especially those of you who are also online. We'll begin the class as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation. We'll set our motivation. The class will begin, and during the class, there are places for questions to be asked and also meditation. But please, first thing is just to be comfortable in your seat. So if your feet are on the floor, then find a cushion or just the floor itself. Try to make sure your feet are flat. Then sort of elongate the spine so the back is nice and straight. And drop your shoulders. And check that your head is sitting very comfortably upon the neck. And either keeping your eyes completely open or partially closed or completely closed, whatever suits you. When you feel comfortable, let your body breathe itself as it has been throughout the day. And as you inhale and exhale, you'll notice that movements take place in the body. So become aware of those movements and the feelings associated with them. While the body continues to breathe itself, imagine in the space in front of you is sitting Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light, and he is sitting on a throne of gold. He is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas, bodhisattvas, and meditational deities. But imagine that surrounding you are all sentient beings. These include your parents, with your mother sitting beside you on the left and your father on the right. So the mother symbolizes wisdom, and the father represents a skillful means or a method. Behind you are your closest friends and family, and in front of you are people you sort of have a bit of aversion towards. You don't have good relationships with them, or you feel unsafe around them. But all of us are looking towards the Buddha. And we recollect that all of us have a wish to avoid suffering, a wish to be happy. And unfortunately, these two wishes have not yet been met. We lack genuine happiness. The causes of suffering can be eliminated, and the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. So, to dispel the causes of suffering and to actualize genuine happiness, we have to release our attachment to the fantasies of this life. Then release attachment to all the pleasures of cyclic existence, to our own singular welfare, and to the belief in an independent and objective reality. So it's possible to develop these abandonments. If we do so, we wish to, not just for our own sake, but for the sake of everyone else. So like we are equal, then I wish to avoid suffering, I wish to be happy, and our lack of genuine happiness. Now, to accomplish these abandonments, we need to rely upon those who have done that, and these are the enlightened beings in front of us. So they've all become enlightened by relying upon the teachings of the Buddha called the Dharma. So decide to develop this Dharma in your mind, the Dharma of abandonments and accomplishments. And to accomplish this, decide to rely upon those who have done it before, the teachings and that community who have the abandonments and the actualizations. To affirm this, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendant. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendant. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendant. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this wish of ours, that we develop our wisdom, compassion, and skillful means, lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being, and it washes over us and all the people surrounding us. And these lights and nectars remove all obstacles to our spiritual path, and they empower our potentials of method and wisdom. We recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and decide to establish all beings into those four states. And so we say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. The response to this wish of ours, again, lights and nectars stream from the heart of each enlightened being that is in front of us and above us. And these lights and nectars reveal these four qualities, which now effortlessly manifest. And we recollect the field of merit, and with faith and devotion, prepare ourselves to purify the mind, to accumulate merit, and to increase it. And the Buddha and his companions now reappear as a field of merit. And in response to their appearance, we say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma to living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to prevent us clinging to the merit and the practices we've just done, we imagine that our body, speech, and mind are our merits. In fact, the whole world around us is utterly transformed through the wisdom realizing emptiness. And depend upon this pure mind that has no clinging, but everything appears as a wonderful and pure land. And in the future, we'll give teachings to all those who have karmic connections with us. So we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirred with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as the Buddha field of love. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Nidam Guru Ratna Mega. to release the offering, and the Buddha accepts it with enjoyment, and he looks at us, and we look up at him, and we look into his eyes. And looking into the eyes of the Buddha, we feel accepted and we feel at ease. Then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, moves through space, and it comes to the bite above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Now the emanation starts to descend, entering the crown, entering the top of your head, coming down through the skull, down through the throat, and down to your heart. At the level of the heart, the emanation begins to expand, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. And these begin to pour out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. And every being exists within space, and all these beings are now established to be within the enlightened state. And from within that enlightened state, you hear the mantra of the Buddha revealing the path to enlightenment. You join in saying, Tathāgata Buddhe Mahāṃ Buddhaya Sovā Tathāgata Buddhe Mahāṃ Buddhaya Sovā Mahāṃ And you just keep reciting it under your breath and just sort of feel the energies moving throughout your body. Think you've accomplished your own purpose and accomplished the purpose of others. And also realize that this meditation was on imagination, which has imprinted the mind with this potential to awaken for the benefit of all beings. So just rejoice in that and decide that in the future you'll actually put into place all the causes and conditions to actualize enlightenment for all living beings. Now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth. And set your awareness, your eyes open, move your body in whichever way you'd like to feel comfortable. This is our second class, and in the first class we looked at the spread of the Dharma from India to China, Mongolia, Japan, and the rest of the world. And we acknowledge that there are four major Tibetan lineages of Mahayana Buddhism in Tibet. These are the Nyingma, Kagyu, Shakya, and Gelugpa, and our center is based around the Gelugpa lineage. Finally, we looked at the center itself and the origins and how it's been going for 40-odd years. Today, we're going to be looking at how to listen to this Dharma and the different attitudes you can bring to it to support listening.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have a look at the life of the Buddha through the lens of the 12 deeds. So, the material that I've drawn upon to present to class is these set of books here. So, all of these have sort of a story about the Some of them are particularly well written. So this book up the top, one written by Karen Armstrong. So Karen Armstrong was once a Catholic nun, Nancy's got a really, I really appreciate her presentation. It's nice to get a different way of looking at what the Buddha is. That's good writing. The next one, Awaken, the Awakened One, A Life of the Buddha. Beautiful way of writing, very easy to read. This one had Gautama Buddha and an End of Suffering. Again, very easy to read, and they come out slightly different. And I've heard many people say this Old Path, White Clouds by Thich Nhat Hanh, the story of the Buddha. They love it, but really good. Down the bottom here is a book called Approaching the Buddhist Path. So, there they have a brief presentation of the Buddha, too. And especially just how to listen to and how to explain the teachings. Like I said, nearly all these books here, except the bottom one down here, Approaching the Buddhist Path, really deal with the life story of the Buddha. We're going to start off with how to listen to the teachings and the benefits of doing so. So, although in the Lam Rim, which is this one here, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment, it's a commentary. They have quite an extensive presentation of how to listen and the benefits of listening and so forth. So we'll look at some of the benefits of listening. I've only got four here, but there are many within the text. Okay. So the first benefit of listening is that you actually get to understand what we're talking about. So we have some way of, like, by listening, we understand what Dharma is. So there are quite a few definitions of Dharma, quite a few different ways of explaining it. There is what they call the Dharma. So a couple of things. So Dharma defined, one is, Dharma is just a thing. So like this is a Dharma. The camera is a Dharma. It's just another name for phenomena. And when it's like that, it's often spelled with a small d. It's not a big d, it's a little d. It was the way the original, when the monks and so forth put together the Buddha's teachings, their way of, they sort of looked quite deeply into them, and they looked at it and they found out that they're trying to find the smallest things possible that make up stuff. In the Greeks, it was atoms. They've got the atomic theory. The Buddhists came up with the Dharma theory. They've got all these little things. And so this here is a Dharma, but it's made up of more Dharmas. They're like all the parts. So every part of this clock is also called a Dharma, and the clock itself is a Dharma. So it's just another word for thing or phenomenon. That's one meaning. The one that we're probably most familiar with is the teaching. And that's often spelled with a capital D, like Dharma. So that teaching, this is called the Dharma of, we call it study, but it's a Dharma whereby you listen and you sort of like understand. But there's another type of Dharma called the Dharma of realization. So that there's Dharmas that we can know about, but then we know more deeply about them. And so that's called the Dharma of realization. So it is the Dharma that puts an end to our suffering if we apply it. When it's asked, we might be asked, so what is the Dharma? The sort of scholastic answer is true paths and true cessations. That's the Dharma. So a true path is just the means or a method that produces a result, and the result is the true cessation, meaning whatever caused suffering, it's over. That doesn't arise anymore. It's like having, so just imagine this here was an affliction. Imagine this is anger, right? So I want to get rid of it. My path might be, throw it on the ground, smash it up. Right? And then it's like, so it's broken, it's gone. So we have to we use wisdom to apply it to our afflictions. So this is the path. and interrelate and using that path, the affliction vanishes, is destroyed. And we have this, what we call a true cessation. So the affliction can no longer arise or trouble us. So a second benefit of listening is that wrongdoing is turned away from. So let's see. One of the things the Buddha said is he said, my teachings or my Dharma goes against the stream. So what does this mean? So, you know, have a streams, you know, like that. They flow one way, don't they? Like the normal stream of water. That usually goes one way.
It's on the tide.
Well, this is the river, not a sort of thing. However, yeah, but whatever way it goes, you're going to swim up against it. So it's hard. In other words, it's difficult. So I tell you why it makes what's difficult about it. So the first thing is that our normal way of looking at the world is like there's a world out there, which looks like it, doesn't it? And our problems are coming from out there. The source of all our problems is like out there. Certainly, I'm sure it certainly looks like that if you look at what's going on in the world today, doesn't it? We say, well, there's a few people in America that are doing this and that, and all over the place are causing lots of problems. So it looks like the problems are coming from beyond us, out there. The vast majority of people, that's what they think and that's how they behave. The Buddha says, no, the actual sources of your problems are coming from within your mind. They're not out there, they're back in here. So that's not an easy thing to change your mind about. It's a complete reversal of how we've been brought up in this life. So what does it mean? So this wrongdoing is turned away from. It means that when you create a wrong activity, it's coming from in here, and the result is also produced in here. The major result is produced back here. We will experience it. So that means that if you understand this, you will stop doing this, because every time you do something wrong, you harm yourself. Every time you hurt someone else, you think, wow, so bad people out there that need to be stopped, and I'm prepared to do whatever it takes. If you hurt them, you hurt yourself. So this is what makes it quite easy in a way to stop doing. If you understand this principle of inner or mental cause and effect, you won't do it. It's a natural way of just restraining yourself. So remember what Robina said one time, really what Robina, she said, you know, because causes can be created pretty much immediately, but the effects come a long time after. We don't tie cause and effect together. And she said, but you know, just imagine this. You know, most of us don't like cockroaches, right? And many people, as soon as they see them, they kill them straight away. So you imagine if cause and effect took place pretty much immediately. So you want to kill the cockroach, you kill it, you die. That's how it would work. Right? You break its back, your back is broken. So you think, wow, okay, then this is a good reason for me not to behave unskillfully. So wrongdoing, in a way, if you take this idea of internal cause and effect, it's a nice natural way. You don't have to force yourself to stop your wrongdoing. You understand every time I do wrong, I hurt myself as well as somebody else. The other great benefit of listening to Dharma is it's what's called the meaninglessness. The meaningless is turned away. So one for me that really stands out here is, if you can imagine yourself lying on your guest bed right now, today, then you look back over your life and go, what have I done that was meaningful and useful in my life? Well, you could say, what have I done that has no meaning at all? And it's like, right at this moment, you say, well, I watched a lot of TV. That's for sure. Yeah, I slept a lot. Yeah, I did all these sort of things. But here I am, I'm about to die. What happens next? What's going to happen? Well, many of us might think, in the normal way, nothing. We're going to be dead, and that's it. But again, if you start looking at cause and effect, you'll find that this can't work like that. In fact, just before I came here, I've been looking for what I might watch tonight on TV. I found this great thing where the doctors are talking about continuation of consciousness. So they're sort of saying that our ideas that consciousness produced by the brain is wrong, because we can have people without any functioning of brain and consciousness is still there. So I knew I'm going to watch this tonight. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. But Western doctors will go out and say that. So again, so this gets this wrong idea of consciousness being produced by physical material. And so yeah, so meaningless things are turned away from. So what you'll find is there's a lot of stuff you just will stop doing because it doesn't contribute to your long-term happiness. You understand it's your mind that produces happiness and suffering. But there's a lot of things that you just stop doing. They seem like meaningless. And so at the moment, I'm visiting a couple of people who are they're dying right now. And like they're in this thing of like looking back, like, what was the point of my life? And it's like, well, I don't know. You have to answer that yourself, don't you? And sometimes it's very hard to know what have I done that was useful and meaningful in my life. In fact, when my sister passed away, I said to her, she's about to die, I said, look, try to think of something really positive and good. And she said, like what? I said, yeah, that's right. It's really difficult sometimes, like when you're in that position. You know, I was about this. I said to her, well, you raised a daughter. Right? That is an amazing thing to do, to raise a child. That's good. And she had done that. It was like, and she was a teacher also. She taught a lot of people. But, I reminded, this is good. What you do. So it's like, oh, yeah. But like I said, many times it's difficult to remember the good stuff we did. It's very easy to remember the bad. That's just it's there. When you listen, it's called then nirvana is attained. So it's called nirvana is a state of peace where the afflictions are no longer present. So if you listen to how to actualize that state, then you should understand, okay, this state called nirvana is possible. So give many analogies to help us understand this and sort of have confidence in it. And so one of them is the analogy of the dusty mirror. So if you have a mirror and over time this has been in the room, the dust accumulates and it covers the surface of the mirror. And then if you were to look into that mirror while it's dust covered, it's very unclear, isn't it? Sometimes you might not even be able to see, well, very little there. But you can go up and just grab a cloth, wipe it across, and all the clarity just returns. Now, the dust has never permeated into the mirror. It's just covered the surface. And from the Buddhists say, that's exactly how the disturbing emotions work too. They never enter the nature of the mind. Just like the dust never enters the nature of the mirror. It can obscure, which it does. Of course, every affliction obscures the mind. Like, for instance, the other day, I got quite upset at something, right? So it wasn't anger, but it was like, and when it did, I couldn't think clearly. So again, this is just an example of how an affliction, like anger, can just color the mind and you can't call upon your reason. In fact, this is one of the things that His Holiness said. He said, one of the worst things about anger is it prevents you from being reasonable. And it does, doesn't it? But at the same time, anger has not entered into the nature of the mind. It's just like the dust, just obscures seeing clearly. And that obscuration can be removed. So they often say this. So what we need to understand, I guess, conceptually, is that listening, and here we need to include reading. In the Tibetan tradition, it's an oral tradition. So they would, just like here, right? So you get a teacher sitting up and they go, talk, 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 talk for a couple of hours, and you're meant to sit there and like listen and take it all in. This is not easy for us, right? We can sit and watch TV for a couple of hours, but to listen to someone talk for a couple of hours, yeah, it's a little not so easy. But we could easily get engrossed in a book or a movie for a couple of hours, couldn't we? And so Dharma, as we know, is in movies and it's also in books. So this idea of listening is just a sort of umbrella where anyone could take the Dharma in. And when we take the Dharma in, either through listening or reading or watching, the idea, I think, is like this, what I'm taking in, it has to help me deal with my own confused states of mind. There was one like a Kadampa master said this great thing, his students are, so what's Dharma? He said, anything that works against the afflictions is Dharma. If it's not, it's not Dharma. Oh, man, that's a great little pithy saying, isn't it? So if you're not working against your own afflictions, what dharma are you practicing? That's basically what he's asking you. When we think about dharma and we hear the stuff, one of the things we need to walk away with is to always remember that our past mistakes are basically rooted in a lack of clear information. So what I'm saying here is do not say harsh things about yourself to yourself. It's all untrue, but it will produce an effect on you. And it won't be a good effect because this is how cause and effect works. Talk to yourself harshly and see what happens. You just feel terrible. This is like somebody else talking to you badly, but you feel terrible. Well, you're talking to yourself that way. You see, the afflictions aren't part of our actual nature. Although we say things like, oh, I'm useless, I'm so stupid, these sort of things. In fact, we're not. We should be saying sort of, oh, like I had this thought. We shouldn't tie our thoughts into thinking that's me. That's right. That's right. I get agitated, comes up. That's right, Sandy. Yeah, this is right. In fact, I think one probably the only bit of talking to yourself harshly is to have that response and you go, there's the object to be negated. And I that seems to jump out on its own. And again, that's a good thing. Okay, so how do we actually get to listen? How do we listen? Okay, so here we've used what they call the simile of the three cups. The first cup is the cup that's upside down. So imagine you've got a teapot full of tea. It's a really nice tea. You want to have a cup of tea. But when you go to pour it, you don't actually turn the cup up to pour the tea into it. What do you think is going to happen?
Pours all over the cups and makes a big mess.
You,
And
so,
there's none in your cup.
there's no tea in the cup. Analogous. What's this, an analogy for then?
Having a closed mind and not listening to, not being open to new information.
Yeah, that's a good bit. Yeah, so we actually, it's like saying you don't even hear the teaching. That's why it can't go in. So why not do we not hear the teaching?
Not paying attention.
We don't pay attention. We might be paying attention to something else. Like you see, it's quite funny sometimes. I think these huge gatherings of people listening to dharmas
Oh
and they're on their phones. And it's talking to them, right? So the teaching doesn't go in. Right? So it's not, we're here, we're putting time into this. Like I said, open yourself up, be open to this. You've come here for this purpose, to hear it, to do something with it. You want to hear it. Now, this is right. This is, I think, what you're saying, Ben. We're not paying attention to the instruction. And so many people go along to Dharma centers because they like the people there. You know? It's more of a social thing than a the thing you'd come along and go, okay, I've got to take something away from here, make some difference to my life. But that's only going to happen if you turn your hearing on and go, okay. In fact, one of the best things I've found to do is whenever you go to these teachings, just decide to take one thing away with you. Well, you'll take, like Chris is writing notes, a number of people are writing notes. Geshe used to say, don't just write the notes and put them in your back pocket. You should take just one thing that you can apply and apply it and see what happens. Otherwise, you might spend years and years listening and agreeing and thinking, oh, it's nice, I meet nice people, I like these teachings. But in terms of making change, it doesn't happen. And so you don't have to wait for years and years to decide, okay, now I'll apply it. You can find something in all these teachings that is useful. So we've got to be like an upside-down cup because then the teaching can't get in, just like the tea can't get into the cup. Second wrong way of listening, and probably the worst, is to come to the teachers, what they call it, with a dirty cup. So here we have a cup that has not been cleaned. So whatever goes into it is going to be affected by an unclean cup. So this is how food poisoning takes place, isn't it? It's just, you have the thing hasn't been cleaned, you put new food in, you ate it, and next thing you've got a big tummy ache and you're in trouble, right? So the idea behind this, and there are people that do this, they come along to talks here to have an argument with the teacher or disprove them. But so they're not coming like open-minded, they're coming in with this idea that, like, I know a little bit more about the stuff they did, I want to try and prove them wrong. Ben?
I was just thinking of something else, so I can strip the shape as this term Abrahamic residue, where we hear these teachings from our Christian upbringing, we listen, we translate through those terms rather than hearing it as it is.
So what this means is sort of we come in with our afflictions. So some of the major afflictions, of course, are pride or arrogance. We're trying to listen to find fault in the teaching or in the teacher. So I remember this when I was very young. I'd never been to a Dharma teaching. I was something about 13, 14, I think. And I came home, and there was black and white TV then, and they had this great Hindu master speaking on the television, right? But while he was speaking, he was poking his nose like this. And I just saw that. I didn't hear any teaching. I just saw him poking his nose. And he's just like, yeah. So I just come up with ideas about the man and so forth. And it took nothing away because of my attitude. Just give as an
But
example.
also, like, he's doing something that is very distracting as well. Maybe other people didn't see him, but he picked
I'm sure a lot of people didn't. They weren't focused on
him.
doing that. They were actually listening to what he had to say. Whereas I started off that way, but then I got distracted by his finger up his nose. So if that happens, of course, then we don't get the teaching purely. It's filtered through our own conceptions and ideas. The last one, of course, is what they call the cracked cup. So here, like the tea goes into the pot, but it pours back out. This is analogous to us, like listening as we are now, and then the teaching finishes. And then we'll go out, and one of you might say to the other, oh, what do you think when they said this? And I said, what? So it's been forgotten. We heard it, but we forgot. Again, this is not an uncommon thing to happen. So, like I said, for those of you taking notes, you guys know, don't you? Like, if you take notes of that, when you go home, you want to review it within the first hour. Otherwise, you're sort of wasting time. And when you get up in the morning, have a look again. Just go over my notes. It won't take you long, but it helps you retain the knowledge. Whereas if just listed in writing, it'll quickly go out. In fact, when I was a beginning student, when I first started, so I did just what you guys do, wrote, took notes. I got books going back 20 years of notes. Yeah, when I look at them now, it's like I've just seen the brand new for the first time. Wow, that was really great. It's like, I got no idea. These great teachings. I read those notes. So again, instead of putting them in the back pocket, he used to say, put them in the computer your mother gave you. Which is your heart or your brain. Don't just put them in your back pocket and sit on them or write them in books and then they sit there for 20 years and you look at it and you're amazed at what you heard and you don't remember any of it.
I'm not the greatest at reviewing my notes afterwards, but the kinesthetic aspect of actually writing and listening helps me retain better than just not doing anything.
Yeah, that's what Miffy does too. So it writes, it keeps you focused. I was going to say, I was doing what most people do. Then I found a more effective method. So I'd listen and I'd hear what they had to say. I'd try to think of a simile or a metaphor to sum it up. I sit there like that and go, I'm just going to listen, and then go, what's the most important thing I think they said? And just write that. That's in my own words. Or like I said, create a metaphor or a simile. And that's helped me retain all of the material. So what this is sort of getting at here is, it's trying to tell us that our attitude will dictate the value of the lesson. So again, just quickly, so when it's upside down, nothing goes in. When it's cracked, it goes in, but it goes out, which means we've heard it, but we forgot it. And the last one is we've heard it, but it's been filtered through pride or aggression or tiredness, all sorts of things that affect our ability to listen. When other people give you this teaching, it's always this part here, and then they complement it with another part. So there's the three wrong ways of listening, and then the six helpful methods to listen correctly. So, like I said, I've been teaching this material for quite some time, and I still find myself not doing this. And you might find yourself too, I don't know. But it's a very simple thing. So here we go, let's take these six helpful attitudes, helping us to listen. So the first thing we should do is to perceive ourselves as a patient, that we're sick. In fact, Rabina always, she's the shock classes, and she starts saying, we're all junkies. She's just straight up and got your attention. Huh? And then, junkies are sick people, aren't they? People who experience an illness. So saying we've got to recognize that we're also ill is a way of looking at things. So what does this mean? Well, aren't we overcome oftentimes by our own mental afflictions? Don't we get angry, scared? Aren't we fearful? Sometimes aren't we doubtful? All these sort of things. So we're not healthy. We're not mentally healthy. So also look at yourself as being unwell. So you come to the center to get yourself well.
So you don't make other people sick.
That's right. No, we're not sick. We're just sick, but we don't make other people sick too. No, I never thought of that. That's great. So when we find ourselves sick, what do you normally do?
Go and see a
doctor. That's exactly right. And this is the same thing here. So when we come in here and I'm sitting up here prescribing, look at the teacher as being the doctor. So I know there's people in here who are very new to this material and This will be the first time you ever heard it, but there are others who've been here for quite some time. So tell me, Ben, when you walked down the driveway, did you walk down thinking, oh man, I'm so sick. I'm so glad to come to the hospital. This says I listen to my doctor.
I have had similes of that at times.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Me too. I walked out here. I didn't have that attitude. And you won't find you're the same. In fact, I remember one time, we'll do the next one. So look at the teachers being someone who's trying to help you get well. Part of what we call the good news, the Dharma, there's a way out of something we experience. We don't have to go through it. Now, this teacher, of course, just like a doctor, he's going to listen to your problems. He's going to prescribe some medication. So, like I said, the medication of the Dharma is like medicine to put an end to suffering, either completely or partially. Now, has anybody here ever got prescriptions from doctors and get the medicine and they don't take it?
Mm.
Yeah, me too. Or you don't complete the course of medicine? Sort of thing. So here's the medicine for us is to actually practice what we're here. We've got to adopt something of what we're here. Otherwise, we're sick. We just stay sick. You know, we got the medicine. We know what's the cause of it, but we don't do anything about it. So one time, many years ago, our teacher, a Tibetan Lama, arrived late at the center. It was quite, they were all sitting there, he was not there. And it was unusual, right? No phone call, nothing. And finally they turned up and he sat down and gave the teaching. What had happened, they'd been in a traffic accident. And so it took them so long to get at it. And so I guess it says, like, nothing about it until right after the teaching was finished, right? But anyway, some people had this response of, oh, I guess so. You know, they're really concerned. They really wanted to see him because he was there. Right? And he was quite wrathful. He said, you don't come here to see me. You come here to take the Dharma. You come here to take the medicine. So, you know, quite really firm. You know, and I heard this, I was like, wow. This idea is like, because there are plenty of people who like, you know, there are some amazing teachers and people like them. So they want to go, I just want to see Geshe-la. I want to see the teacher. And it does make you feel nice, you know, it does make you feel pleasant when you're around these authentic people. But like he's saying, it's not going to help you a great deal. You have to take my medicine. If you don't take the medicine, you're not going to get well just by looking at me or being around me. So you come here, you come to the centers for the teaching, for the Dharma. So these are four of the most, these are the most important aspects of this, they call correct way to listen. There are two others, and that is that one that we say, we perceive the Buddha as a holy being. So as you become used to the path and its different stages and so forth, there is a stage within your training where you try to adopt the view that the teacher is the actual Buddha. Whether they are or not, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that you should adopt the view that they are. Any idea what that might be?
The way it affects your own mindstream.
Yeah, that's right. The way it affects your own mindstream. So if he was an amazing enlightened being in front of us here, how would it affect your mindstream? How would it affect your mind?
You'd listen more carefully.
Oh, yeah. You'd listen more carefully. You'd have a lot of respect for them, eh? A lot of humility. You probably want to be like them. Now, so there's many, many benefits if you can look at the person from the very highest point of view. It doesn't do anything for them. Like I said, from their point of view, from the teacher's point of view, they're not to grab hold of that and start using it against you. It's for your benefit, this idea. try and look. As you know, like a Buddha has, well, it doesn't have any problems, doesn't have any afflictions, they're called, they're all good. So if we can relate to them as if they actually were, this ordinary person seeing through, if they're actually enlightened, it's hugely beneficial for yourself. It does nothing for them. They don't, we don't, if I'm up here, I don't need you to think of me for myself, I don't need you to think of me as a Buddha, but for your own benefit, it's very good, very useful. Yes, it is. Yeah, it's the same principle, isn't it? It is. So we've got this perceiving the Buddha as this holy being, and or your teacher as the Buddha, as a holy being. And then you produce this wish. So you wish, oh man, I hope this Dharma never gets lost. So once you get a bit of understanding, your depth, your understanding of it, believe me, this will come to you naturally, this last one. You know, when you understand it, oh my gosh, it's the mind itself. If I can discipline my mind, if I can have it think in the correct ways, in good ways, my suffering will decrease. If I don't, if I let my mind run on and do what it's doing, if I just let it do what it wants to do, I'm going to experience suffering. So we have this choice. Do we want to discipline the mind? Now, I think for me, what was difficult about hearing this is the word discipline. I don't like it. You tell me, discipline me, oh, I'm going to get argy party straight away. Right? But here's like we are doing this to ourselves. And it's, in a way, it's like, look, when you discipline your own mind, you're being compassionate towards yourself. You understand. Actually, it's my mind, when I don't keep an eye on it, will do things that will cause me suffering. But if I can keep my mind on it and direct it, then suffering will be less. The Buddha Dharma is what do you call it? Non-aggressive. It is not meant to hurt. It's not meant to harm people. We use the idea, the only thing it's meant to harm is the afflictions. Because they're the producers of all the harm. That's the need to stop them. But it's basically a really gentle process. It starts off with it just says, look, first of all, don't do the things that hurt you. That's how gentle it is. And so these things will hurt you. Killing people, stealing, sexual misconduct, harsh speech, lying, gossiping. These things will hurt you. Just stop yourself doing it. So that's your regulations. Just say no to drugs. Say no to the afflictions. So you process gently. So you guys, I guess now's the question time, folks. Is there anything you'd like to ask about this? Okay, I'll ask you guys a question. So we talked about these three cups, right? How does an upside down listener differ from one who is leaking?
The upside down listener has no interest at all in hearing what's been going on.
So you say, so it doesn't go in at all?
Yeah.
That's right.
The leaky cup, you are listening, you do want to listen.
Yeah.
It's just that you don't bother to remember.
That's right. So it's actually gone in, so the teaching has actually gone in 3 years, but you forget it. The one is it doesn't go in at all, so you can't forget it because it never went in the first place. The other one is actually it did go in, I did hear it, but I forgot them. So why is the dirty pot metaphor considered the most dangerous of these three listening pots? Well, you get the information and then you add stuff to it that makes it wrong.
The information is contaminated.
Yeah.
It doesn't, so... You're actually having one view. You're getting that. You're getting information, but you're not processing it in the correct way.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Good. That's a great question. It's a really important question. This one. So as you all know, there are many Buddhist books out there. Lots and lots of texts. Lots of teachings. And. There are many different ways of presenting this knowledge. and you have many people presenting it. So it's quite possible that you might be what they call a, what sort of teacher would that be? A false teacher. That is to
charlatan.
Charlatan, that's right. And so they might actually alter the teachings themselves to benefit them rather than you. That's a possibility. Or what they might do is use these teachings, yeah, use the teachings against you for their benefit. There are people like this. So it's really important that we check the teaching and the teaching.
That's possible.
So in, I think, well, in this tradition, I'm pretty sure in all of the Buddhist traditions, what they often do is they start off by going, where does this teaching come from? So you normally always see, where's the, what's the source of this teaching? So then it's got to have from a Buddhist, a legitimate source. Not only does the source have to be legitimate, but the teacher should also be an authentic teacher. And then, so what he's got to do is make sure that what's in that source comes across clearly and correctly. So as beginners, it's not easy to discern this, is it?
Mm.
Yeah. So Ben's just raised a really interesting point, a really good one. And as Holiness often brings this up too, it's just a technique called the Four Reliances. This is, do not rely upon the teacher, rely upon the teaching. But that means you have to examine the teaching, of course. What's the next one, Ben?
I think it's rely on the
not the interpreter. And so then when you look at these teachings, there's different types. There's some that have to be interpreted and some that are definitive. So let's take these ones that are definitive.
That's
I've got it. Hang on. Do not rely on the...
person, rely on the teacher.
Yeah, yeah. Do not rely on the individual, but on the Dharma. Do not rely on the words, but the meaning. Good. Do not rely on the provisional meaning, but the definitive meaning. Do not rely on the ordinary mind, but rely on wisdom.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. We have to bring that in. Yeah, so, again, yeah, this doesn't mean that we're like, we have a dirty cup or anything. But doubt is allowed here. We're allowed to question everything we hear. This is something I really do like about this Buddha Dharma. It's not like, here it is, you have to eat it like this, and this is it. So we don't have to do that. You can raise your arm and go, explain, tell me more, you know. What about this? What about that?
Something I noticed with the visiting teachers we've had, even Geshe Sherrod the other week, he very clearly outlined where his teaching and transmission has come from and what the lineage is, and Geshe's opus done that too.
Yeah, that's right.
So
they're all doing the same. They go back to the source. They said, this is the teacher who passed it down to me, and these people passed it down to them, and this is where I studied it, and so forth. In fact, one time, Kensa Rinpoche again, so he started off, he said, this teaching came down to me from the Dalai Lama. And he said, and the Dalai Lama got this teaching from this person. And this person got the teaching from this person. So they can actually know, like, you know, you track back. So there's nothing like made up or it's brand new teaching or anything like that. So let's do a meditation and we'll continue. Yeah, let's be comfortable in the seat. Drop your shoulders, keep your back straight. And bring your attention to the breath. And allow the mind to rest fully in the present. And set an altruistic intention to listen so that you may become a source of wisdom. I want you to imagine yourself as a patient seeking a cure for the chronic illness of confusion. You realize that the wisdom required to overcome this chronic illness of confusion, this wisdom will be useless to you if you don't actually receive it. If you are like a vessel turned upside down. But effective listening requires transforming your mind into a vessel free from the three traditional flaws. You remember what those three mistaken ways of listening were. There's the upside down cup, and what does that sort of represent? It's the teachings that go in at all. Then there's the cup with the crack in it. So the teachings have actually gone into your mind, but they've also left, so you've forgotten them. And then there's the pot that was dirty. What happens there? Yeah, so you've come to listen, but you've brought your own conceptions into it. You've sort of mixed it up. Sometimes it might have been brought into the teaching an afflictive mental state. And this will affect what you listen to. You want to avoid being like an upside down pot, the leaky pot, or the dirty pot. But how do we ensure that we are truly receptive to the transformative words of the teacher? To remove closed-mindedness, but to let the wisdom in. And how can we ensure that the wisdom stays within us instead of quickly vanishing? I need to patch the holes of forgetfulness to ensure that the mind retains every drop of medicine. So view the teacher as a doctor and the teachings as the precise medicine that you need. And how do we prevent personal biases from distorting the purity of this truth? Through the motivation. With motivation, we cleanse the pot of wrong ideas and misconceptions. We listen to the heart, empty of pride and ego. We try to apply the medicine through practice. Try to listen to the teachings. Take them as a prescription for spiritual growth or mental growth. Now breathing in through nostrils, exhale. So now we come to this. So this part I think is quite important of how to listen. Now we come to sort of the life story of the Buddha. So this story, so you must probably, all of you have heard the story of the Buddha or read of it. So this story is presented in a pictorially as the 12 deeds. And this is not an historical story. It's not history. It's hagiography.
What's that word for you?
Hagiography. Now, hagiography is a spiritual biography. It has nothing to do with actual history. The purpose is to make a difference to the person who hears the story. And this life story of the Buddha is presented three different ways. So the first was the way that it's presented in the Pali tradition. And that story is primarily history. And they don't have 12 deeds, they have 8. There's only 8 major factors in the life story of the Buddha. Then we have what they call the Mahayana tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, you've got Sutra and Tantra. And the way it's presented there, sorry, in the way, the first one with the Pali tradition, the Buddha starts off as an ordinary person like us. Right? He's got problems, he's living in a, he becomes like a king of a tribe of people, but he's got problems. He knows he's got problems, and he leaves his palace. This is a story you're probably all familiar with. Leaves the palace, he goes off and becomes enlightened in that lifetime. And he teaches for the next 45 years. Right? So that's the Pali traditional story. Mahayana come along, Buddha was already enlightened. So it's a different perspective. It's, now we've got this man already enlightened, and all the stuff is just like a show. And this was the perspective adopted by the Mahayana and the four lower tantras. Then there's another presentation where it's presented from the point of view of the highest yoga tantra. So you've got three ways of telling the story of the Buddha. One sort of mainly historical from the Pali tradition, the other very different. Now, this one is like Buddha's already, this fellow called Buddha, he's already enlightened. Been enlightened for a long, long time. And just kept, it's just like a play. But again, remember, this is not really about the history. This is about trying to convince Buddhists to have faith in it and so forth and adopt, and blah, blah, blah. Now,
sorry,
just,
can I just quickly ask? So he's already enlightened, but he's still the prince.
So in this presentation, the Pali tradition have eight major things that happen to them. I'll show you as we go through the slides. The Mahayana takes all those eight and add another four to it. Just to sort of fill out the picture, so to speak. But each of these D's has a completely different meaning. This is here. The hagiography demonstrates very pointedly the central vision of Buddhism. The gap between the way things appear to be and the way things really are. So if you hold on to that idea, everything else, you just relax. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all conventions. That's right. None of them are ultimate truths. They're just conventions to help people who are engaged in the study of the Dharma. It's primarily for the recipients. These should be read as an illustration of what is to Buddhists important. It can be safely said of Buddhist hagiography in general that the teachings of the Dharma outrank by far what we call attention to in history. So, we put quite a lot of emphasis on history, don't we, in the West. In the East, they don't. That's not the thing. The real major thing is what's going on here. How can we transform our inner lives? Not about history over time and all that sort of stuff. But it's not really their go.
Eddie, where is that quote from?
It's from a book called Buddhist Thought by Paul Williams. It's on page 27. The Mahayana and the Vajrayana traditions emphasize the Buddha's pre-existing enlightenment, while Theravada focuses more on the journey to enlightenment. Now, this is useful to know because one time I was at a large gathering of Buddhists. And I was put onto a panel with another couple of people to talk about the life of the Buddha. So I knew this, and I sat there and listened, and I knew the people, other people responded, didn't know this. Their approach was like real, real deal thing, the history thing. Right? And it was like, gee, I should be really careful now about how I respond, isn't it? Because you don't want to say something and the other person is sitting beside you looks a little bit foolish or something, right? So it's useful to recollect this idea that it's three different aspects. It's like, this happens all the time, doesn't it? Something takes place and you get people who write about it differently. And this is the same idea. Again, like I said, it's not history, these 12 beds. Hagiographies are common in all religions, right? You get the stories of the saints are all hagiographies. The idea is you're looking at that life and trying to make it have an impression on you in terms of your practice. So let's look at these 12 deeds. So the first one is called the Descent from Tushita Pure Land. And this descent is common in the Theravada tradition, the Mahayana tradition, and the Vajrayana tradition. So they've all got this first step in it, right? And as you know that story, don't you, is that there's the Buddha to be is a 10th ground bodhisattva. He's up in this Tushita heaven. He looks down at the earth and says, wow, these people are all ready for these teachings. So now I'm going to leave the heaven. I'm going to give the crown to Maitreya. You look after heaven Maitreya. I'm going to go down to earth and help the people. So this is what they call the first step, the descent from Tushita Pure Land. In Higher Soka Tantra, this part here represents the descent of subtle consciousness from the crown chakra. Okay, I won't say too much about Higher Soka Tantra because most of you don't know anything about it. But like I said, remember there's three aspects here. One that's going to sort of get your head around, and the other is going to be a bit more difficult. But there are three ways of telling the story. Then entry into his mother's womb. So as you know the story, his mother has this dream of a white elephant entering in through her side. The white elephant has six tusks. So this is all symbolism. So white elephant for purity of the mind. The six tusks of the elephant for the six perfections. So it's all symbolic. So this is common to the Theravada and the Mahayana, this part. This one is too. Also, each one's got a quote. So you rose up for the welfare of all beings, lost in the beginningless and fearful states of becoming. And in the third, Buddha takes birth in the beauties. And yeah, it says he came out of the side of his mother. So this is very much like Christ, the virgin birth. This is not an uncommon thing in these religions and so forth. So again, it's symbolic. You know, he takes these seven steps and he says, no more will I be reborn within samsara. This is my last rebirth. So the first three steps are common to the Theravada and Mahayana. Now, this is just Mahayana. He becomes skilled in the arts, playing the sports of youth and so forth. But if you notice, there's this young fellow growing up. He's a great sportsman. Good. And terrific study and so forth. If you think of this in terms of like our lives, is it like this? So we're born, we go after school, do we play sports? We play all these games? It's a similar type of thing they're presenting here. But this is only the Mahayana. This one here is also only in the Mahayana and not the Theravada. As you know, the Buddha gets married, I think he's 16. He marries a girl and she's 14. He also has a harem, many other wives, and so forth. So the quote here, what was his wife's name? Does anybody remember? Yashodhara.
Maya? No, that's his mother.
Yashodhara. She that was ours henceforth was only yours. Be good to her who has her life in you. And so if you know the story, he goes out and he demonstrates all the skills and so forth, and there's this beautiful woman, and she goes, you're the guy for me. You're the woman for me, and they get married. And then again, we have this common deed to the Mahayana and the Theravada. But as you know, one day he sees these four phenomena. So, what are the four phenomena that the Buddha sees?
Sickness, old age.
He sees the person who is sick. He sees the person who is old, he sees the person who is dead, and finally he sees a renunciate. This person is really, you know, sort of glowing and it's really healthy and well done. And the Buddha, sorry, it's not the Buddha yet, right? In this story, he's like the prince, the Shakyamuni. And he looks at it and goes, well, that's the course of my life, isn't it? All I can do is get old, get sick, and die. Like, is that it? I mean, this is a terrific question that we should ask ourselves all the time. Is that the purpose of life? To just survive and procreate and then die? You know, I always thought there's got to be more. There's got to be more than life than just that, surely. And so what happens, of course, the Buddha sees this LFO, and what he sees is, yes, there is more to life, there's freedom. We can be free. And so it's not like an external freedom, it's inner freedom. He sees this fellow has developed it, says, that's what I want to do. And so to that, he leaves the palace. So is there anything that's interesting in those four ones there, please?
Well, the Theravadan tradition.
Yeah.
They talk about that once Buddha becomes enlightened.
Yeah.
His wife becoming enlightened and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And becoming nuns and priests.
Yes, that's right.
Even though they missed that out.
Yeah. It's not one of the major deeds.
Yeah.
It's right. So I was talking about, but it's not, like I say, a feature deed. Anything interesting that you'd like to raise about the spin?
A bit about the birth of Mundane and taking certain steps so I'll never come back again.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of a moot point for someone who's already enlightened anyway?
Well, again, this point to this, so you do that, now you've hopped into the Mahayana. This is Theravada.
Oh, that's
Theravada.
But
yeah.
Didn't say it was both
Theravada. Yeah, and it was Lubini saying, like, he does this thing, but it's like a show. Right? It's like he's acting the part.
So when he says, this is my last three years, that's not for his benefit.
That's no, that's for our benefit.
Right, okay.
So she's now already enlightened, but here, yeah. Like, you know, you've got to start off where you are. Okay, so let's move on because. The next step here we have the gazing in the austerity. So again, this is only Mahayana. And so you'll know if you've read the autobiography. So there's this thing there, and His Holiness has a great statue of the Buddha, you know, emaciated, all the bones. If you read the story, he said, I could get my finger, push it into my belly button, and reach my spine. And he said, I heard all these noises in my body, you know, like gurgling waters and all sorts of things. You bet you would, mate. You're nearly dead. Right? You're that skinny and emaciated, starving. Right? So he goes through this, and you can see you ate poor food, sometimes you ate hungry. But he decided, you know, like, I'm going to get enlightened. I'm not moving from this place. But you know, so he did all this first, though, and then now he reckons, like, this is it's too harsh. This way, it's too hard, tight. I've missed something. I've made some sort of mistake, which is great to hear, isn't it? And he finds out this middle way. So the middle way here is the middle way of like behavior, not so much the intellectual, but like behavior. And when he does that, then he has the gift of porridge at the little girl, because then he heads off to the tree in Bodhgaya, doesn't he? Goes to the tree in Bodhgaya, he sits down. He says, you yourself make the effort for your salvation. The Buddhas are only teachers who can show you how to achieve it. And then, of course, you sit down there to become enlightened, and guess what's going to happen to you?
Temptations.
Yeah. All the stuff, all the deep, unconscious stuff in your mind is going to rise up. That's what it does. And you have to be brave enough and wise enough and compassionate enough to let it happen and not cling. This is very difficult to do, is that anybody who's ever tried to do something like this. Like, the appearances to your mind are so real that you behave as if they're real. In fact, today, my partner woke up this mid-morning with this really bad dream and sat down to talk to me about it, so I listened. I go back to work and she's really upset. It's just a dream. Right? Dreams aren't real. Stop behaving as if they're real. If it's, didn't like that, of course. But it's true. It's true. You know? Stop making stuff up and thinking it's all real and now talking to me about it. What should we do and all this? He's going, no, no, you don't even have to do any of that. Just remember, you know, don't hold on to the mental stuff as if it were real. It's, none of it is. It's just appearances. But like, again, it's really difficult not to do this, especially without training. Anyway, so here goes, and you know, of course, what happens is lust, greed, all the deep stuff comes up and tries to stop him doing what he's doing. So he says here, you have declared the destruction of the defilements. You have exposed Mara's delusions. You have taught the evils of samsara. You have revealed the place like without fear. In other words, so the Buddha is called the fearless one. And this is because he's removed all sources of fear. And the major source of fear is believing in things that are real, which aren't. Like dreams. Like, or your sense of a real me. That's as real as a dream. This is a major source of our suffering. We have an I. We exist. We have an identity. But if you grab it, hold it with your mind, to be something more than just that, trouble comes. So all these demons arise from this false idea of who he is. But she's right through. This is what comes fully enlightened. And this is really interesting too. You know, he says, this Dharma that I've attained is profound. It's hard to see and hard to understand. So he doesn't start to teach anybody for quite some time. It's 49 days or so, a bit longer. And a long time where he just sits in the forest and says, I don't know how to explain this to anyone. What do I, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he finally, you know, he's encouraged to go out and teach people. And this is what he does. It's freedom, the joy of enlightenment, praiseworthy virtues, and peace. These four benefits are all gained from your teaching. So some of you might remember, you know, so that they said that he turns the wheel of Dharma. This was his first teaching. But if you actually read the text, it's not, it's his second teaching. But do you remember what the first teaching was?
Well, it was Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, that's right. But he gives a teaching before the first Four Noble Truths.
Is it when the girl is singing the green grass, the flute?
No. So what happens? So he's attained his enlightenment and he's walking along the road. So who can I tell this to?
Oh, Christ, isn't it all? That's right. Bright,
that's right. That's right. That's right. That's the first teaching. Yeah. And what you see is it's not appropriate for the father. What happens? So he's working out who am I going to teach this to? Like, I go back to my original teacher, he finds that no, he's passed away. What goes, no, he's passed away. Oh, I know the four people. There's people I've been meditating with. I'll go and teach them. So he heads off and he's on his way and he meets a merchant. And this merchant is so astonished at his appearance. He says, what on earth are you? Are you some sort of god or like an angel or what type of human are you? And the Buddha says, I am awake. That's what it says. Right? So what do you think the other guy says to him? Yeah, nothing. It just moves on. You know, yeah, whatever. Yeah, well, it's something. It's definitely not ordinary. But it's like it just, he doesn't ask anymore. He says, well, how did you do it? Yeah. So then by the time the Buddha gets to the four people, now he goes, there is suffering. Suffering exists. Different teaching. Let's start off there. Suffering exists. An end to suffering. Well, these are the causes, an end of it also exists. So he teaches the Four Noble Truths. It's always like that little story. You know, so, you know
you're teaching the result straight away.
Yeah, straight away. That's
and
what
it's
like.
Too much.
Yeah, too much is not comprehensible. And like he said this too, he says, now what I've discovered, how do I share this? Like this is going to be really difficult to explain. So returns the wind of the stomach, and he does this for 45 years. He became enlightened at 35, taught for the next 45 years. And then he passes away in this city. And this is what he says. All component things in the world are changeable. They are not lasting. So work hard to gain your own salvation. Just like, you know, if we wish to be free of suffering, we're going to have to do it ourselves. We're going to have to help, of course, but finally it comes down to us. There's lots of help. We have the teachings. We have a community of people doing this. We've got other realized beings, but they cannot just make us enlightened. We will have to do the hard lifting ourselves.
Madonna? Why is it called passing away from sorrow?
I have no idea.
Was he sad?
I don't think so, no. In fact, when you read, I've got it here, but we're over time. This is what he says, one of the things he says. The only time that the Tathagata can make his body comfortable is when he lives, having attained a state of mental concentration without sensations, and specific feelings cease through not paying attention to any sensations. So Ananda, you should live with yourselves as your island of refuge and not someone else, with the truth as your island of refuge and not something else. So how does one live with oneself as one's island of refuge, with the truth as one's island of refuge? And he says, you should live with full awareness. Watch your body as the body. Become fully aware, mindful. So I really like this idea, because this is the thing that brought me to the Dharma, was the truth. I just want to know what's true. And when you do that, what you're going to discover is a whole lot of conventional truths. So it's lovely. I always thought there was one truth. You know, I'm looking for the truth, one truth. And I could never find it. And the Buddha Dharma says, no, there are two truths in it. One is called the conventional truth, and one's called the ultimate truth. And when I was looking, anyway, this way, what we try to do is integrate these two truths. So the Buddhist way is not one truth, but two truths. Even though in some of the texts, when you look at it, sometimes it really does seem like they're arguing for one truth. That's for sure. That's in there. So there's these 12 deeds, and as I've said, they're explained in three different ways. Theravada really looks at historically and presents as like a historical narrative. It's just like true all the way through. The other people say, no, he was already enlightened. It's just like a play. And this is what the play looks like. So, we'll do our final meditation, and that's our class for today. Again, just have your back straight, your shoulders relaxed. We're going to look at these 12 deeds. So try to develop, create an altruistic intention for listening to them. If you can, try to imagine the profound transition that takes place from a person enduring extreme hardships to become a teacher whose words continue to echo down through the centuries right up to the present day. Now, how did the Buddha sort of transition from years of asceticism, and we became very skinny, 6 years doing that, to the moment of total awakening under the Bodhi tree? So you recognize, first of all, the middle way. Then he defeated the delusions of the mind and realized the ultimate nature of reality. What was the purpose of the Buddha spending 45 years traveling and teaching after his great realization? He turned the wheel of Dharma to provide these specific tools and methods for others to end their own dissatisfied life. And how does this final need of passing into what they call parinirvana continue to assist us today? So this is the 12th need. How does this help us today? So this last need demonstrates the reality of impermanence, while at the same time leaving behind a living lineage of wisdom that we can still access. The way his passing is like the scent of incense that remains in a room long after the flame has gone out. If you can, just try to choose one quality of the Buddha, such as patience or clarity, and try to embody it in your intentions. Whether the path to awakening is open to all of us. As you carry the light of the Buddha's 12 deeds into our own lives. Now breathing into your nostrils, exhaling, and bringing attention back to the room. And finally, I'll finish off with this slide here. So these are, as you can see, there's 12 stamps here. They came out in Bhutan in 2014. No. 12 deeds of Lord Buddha. And that's the end of our class. So what's our takeaway? Well, you do know how to listen. The three bad ways of listening, the six helpful attitudes. And that these 12 deeds are like a hagiography and a teaching device. Try not to look at them like through the historical lens, otherwise there'll be all sorts of problems you'll create for yourself. It doesn't tie in with the way we normally think of history. Next week. So in the meantime, if you'd like to find anything on the 12 deeds, there's plenty online, or those books. Try to recollect these three cups, right? So when you come to teach, you say, okay, I need to, this is the way to listen to it. These are the right ways and not the wrong ways. And if you have verse 2 of the foundation of all good qualities in your possession, or I think it's probably up online as well, have a look at that and see if you can try to memorize verse 2. And next week, what I'll do is go over verse 1 and 2. So if you guys have memorized or have a good understanding, you know, there's only four lines, so this can't read each one. So if you have it, it's not difficult. And we're going to talk about the three capacities of the path and primarily the capacity for a beginner. So what do? We begin engaging in a path of Buddhism. So let's dedicate the effort we've put into our study. But join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, now quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into their enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. A prayer for his love life of His Holiness. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind and get so I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the prayer of the discovery of the reincarnation of Rinpoche, in holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, we wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request.